You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. For this season of Working, we left the East Coast behind and flew to Detroit. We're speaking with eight people who are drawing on the city's complex history as they work to create its future. While we were in Detroit, we kept going back to this one restaurant to have lunch, a place called Slo's Barbecue. Detroit doesn't have its own regional style of barbecue, but Slo's pulls off a fusion of different techniques and approaches that feels personal and smart and, of course, delicious. We were so impressed that we decided to talk to its chef, Mike Mativia, about how he does what he does. Chef Mike led us through the process of planning a barbecue dish and training a staff that can pull it off consistently. He also talks a little about sourcing ingredients, sometimes from other Detroit area establishments, and goes into the basic logistics of running a barbecue joint on a day-to-day basis. And though the magic of radio doesn't allow us, unfortunately, to share a meal with you, Chef Mike does give us an audio tour of the restaurant, which might give you a better sense of what you're missing if you can't make it there. Then, in a Slate Plus extra, Chef Mike shares some tips for home barbecuing. I learned a lot from him as someone who spends a lot of time over the grill in the summer, and I think you will too. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your two-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Michael Mativia. I'm the chef at Slo's Barbecue in Detroit.
What does that involve? What are your daily responsibilities as chef?
My daily responsibility is worrying about the restaurant. It's pretty much all of it, from scheduling the kitchen staff, hiring them, firing them, creating the menus, running the specials, and a lot of fielding emails on my day off. Uh-huh. So yeah, just stay worried about the place, and that's the root of the job.
Is it just this one location that you're overseeing that we're in now?
Yeah, I have minimal involvement in the other locations, but this has been my home base for over 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So were you involved with founding or opening this location?
Yeah, in the sense that I was actually hired on as the sous chef in the early days. Mm-hmm. And we got all our menus completed, recipes written, and then started helping the construction crew. So at a certain point of working 7 days a week, I eventually got sweat equity in the place. Mm-hmm. And that really kept me here for the long haul.
Have you always been a barbecue guy? Is that how you ended up here?
I would say in my personal life, yes. In my work life, no. I've worked in just a variety of different types of restaurants. And when the opportunity to come here came up, combining the restaurant career I was already in with barbecue, I don't know. I just like starting fires, if nothing else. It seemed like a fun opportunity.
Did you go to culinary school before?
No. No, I registered at a certain point and planned on going and just didn't have time. Yeah. I was already getting positions in kitchens as a sous chef and whatnot, and you're putting a lot of hours in doing that. So school never came to pass. I bought the textbooks. I read those.
Were they helpful?
Yeah, I'd say so.
So the menu here, I mean, it's a barbecue place, but the menu is pretty complicated. I mean, it's not just like slab of meat mm-hmm. on a plate. I mean, there are real serious complex dishes, some of the best macaroni and cheese that I've had in a long time, if not ever. What was it like kind of creating the menu? What went into that initial effort to open up a sort of sophisticated but classic barbecue place like this?
Well, the heart of the menu came from Chef Brian Perrone, the executive chef and co-founder with Phil Cooley of the restaurant. When I came in, he already had a vision of where this menu is going. We were looking at kind of representing regional barbecue from around the country, but putting our own Detroit twist on it, I guess mm-hmm. you could say. And I jumped right on that mindset and started contributing items to the menu that I thought kind of stayed within that mindset. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the dishes, it might be a lot of complicated steps that go into them, but it's usually in an effort to serve a really simple dish. Mm-hmm. We're not here to rethink barbecue. We just sure. want people to come here and have fun and feel like they, they got a good deal and maybe did something a little decadent.
Yeah. Is there a particular dish that you're especially proud of that you were involved with that you can tell us about?
Geez, I don't know. I guess I've had involvement in most everything on the menu. Mm-hmm. Maybe the pork belly sandwich called the Nature Boy, because mm-hmm. I found a way to slip Ric Flair into our menu. But I'd say I've got pride in the whole thing, you know.
But tell us about the Nature Boy though. What was the process there? How did that one come to be? What's actually in that sandwich? First of all,
it is ancho rubbed hickory smoked pork belly in a hoagie roll.
How long do you smoke it for?
We smoke it for about 4.5-5 hours, depending on the size of the belly. Then it gets cut into basically small cubes and then broiled till it's crispy. Mm-hmm. We put it in a hoagie roll with bacon aioli and mm-hmm. Baby spinach, pickled onions. Mm-hmm.
It's 11 a.m. and I'm salivating.
Yeah, it's a really good sandwich. It started, though, when I was having lunch at a restaurant in Chicago. I was eating pork belly there and just started thinking about, like, why don't we have pork belly on the menu at home? And, 3 days later, there was that sandwich.
So... when it comes to actually making a sandwich like that, how involved are you in the prep, in the actual production of the food on a daily basis?
It's 100% me in the beginning when it comes to like all of our new menu items and specials. I mean, I'm really the only one touching the food in the beginning.
But so you're just back there in the kitchen trying things out?
I'm back there getting it all prepared. You know, you test recipes and do all that. But once it actually turns into something that we're running on special or it's on the menu, then it gets basically turned over to the staff. So a lot of training comes into play. Mm-hmm. So I make sure the dish is right and then make sure they're trained in how to execute it.
Once a dish like that is on the menu, is it pretty much consistent until you take it off or do you fiddle with it?
No, once it's on the menu, it's on the menu. It's a little different with the specials. I'll usually give the sandwiches some goofy name. Uh-huh. And if I like the name more than the sandwich, I'm more apt to change the sandwich ingredients than the name of it. So
what's it like then being the boss? I mean, it's, one part of your responsibility is, you know, testing out recipes, developing them. But as you said earlier, a lot of it is about hiring the staff, mm-hmm. teaching the staff, maybe even firing the staff sometimes.
I guess you could say it's emotional, you know, you don't want to be stressed out by it, but when you come up working in kitchens, you're not really trained to do the public relations end of things or, like, all the hiring and firing and just dealing with people's personal lives on the day-to-day. So you work for years trying to become a good cook, and the more you move up the ladder, the further you move away from the cooking and the more toward just dealing with people, which takes a lot of practice, and it can be emotional because I'm not somebody who likes to have to fire somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple examples I can think of people who, like, yes, without question, this had to happen. Sure. But other times it's just, you know, you get somebody violating tardiness policies mm-hmm. or whatever it may be that all of a sudden they wander down that path, and I just don't like having to be that guy, but I am, you know, and you do it consistently and stick to your guns with it.
So timeliness, understandably important. What kind of hours do you spend in the restaurant?
In the beginning, it was 7 days a week, you know, anywhere from 80 to 100 hours. That is definitely not the case these days. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a decade later and I still had to do that, I better get better at training staff.
Yeah.
These days, it can float anywhere between 40 and 50. It's much more refined. And even the staff itself, like most kitchens I've worked in when I was younger, like working a 50-hour week is not odd at all. We don't really do that here. We try to structure the kitchen staff so they work a normal 40-hour week. We try to keep their schedules as set as possible. We try to keep a kitchen that's calm and fun to work in because we get busy. We could be on an hour and a half wait, and if you have a kitchen that's used to yelling at each other, it just gets worse and worse. So we got a pretty calm environment back there. Mm-hmm. And the people, we work pretty standard hours.
That's nice.
Yeah.
How do you keep the kitchen calm? How do you keep that sense of stability?
Well, a lot of it comes from me being calm. Mm-hmm. Like I've worked under chefs before that are really hot tempered. And frankly, I'm one of those people, but just because you have a bad temper doesn't mean you can't control it. And I've worked for a lot of people who don't really seem to consider that, and they'll you know, throw a plate or punch a wall or start screaming at the staff. And I've been there, and I just don't like that environment. So I try to stay pretty mellow back there. I try to be very respectful with the staff, and I don't tolerate it if I don't get it back. If I don't get respect back, and if they don't respect one another, like, you're not going to last in this environment. If you come back there and start disrespecting other people, you don't have a job here anymore. And over time, you know, it's pretty easy for people to come in and figure out that, like, this is actually kind of nice. Nobody's going to scream at me today as long as I get my job done. And, you know, then they stick it out. We've got a lot of longevity with our cooks.
Your restaurant is called Slow's.
Yep.
And barbecue is a relatively slow food, mm-hmm. for the most part. That pork belly sandwich you make, four and a half hours
yeah.
in the smoker. The brisket you guys make here, I think, is 10 hours, something like that?
You know, that stuff usually goes at least 12, you 12? Know, sometimes 13, depending yeah. on how big the meat is.
So does that element of the food you're making here contribute to the tone, the style, the feel of the restaurant at all?
I hope so. Yeah. You know, when the place was named Slow's, at the time it was kind of a tribute to the slow food movement in Italy, which is kind of a calling to people to slow down their lifestyle, starting with your food, like get away from fast food, go back to cooking with your family and slowing things down. And maybe it has. Like, barbecue is not a stressful food. It's a patient food, and it takes a lot of love and respect. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe it's the food making it happen. I hope I have a little to do with it, but it's probably just the brisket.
Yeah. What about sourcing ingredients? Are you involved with supplying the restaurant with the various
yeah.
meats and stuff?
You know, sourcing, we've gone through a lot of changes over the years as we've grown, because it's been our effort to keep everything all natural. But as you start selling more product, it becomes more difficult to find suppliers that can keep up with you, especially when you've got a few different stores open trying to sell the same things. But what we do like to do in the different Slows, being Pontiac, Grand Rapids, our to-go location, is to run different specials there. And I personally like to, as much as I can, source ingredients for those specials locally. Mm-hmm. Like, I buy a whole hog every week or two from a local farm, and we smoke that outside. Now that summer's upon us, there's a couple little farms in the area. We like to buy, like, lettuces or whatever they might have. You know, you don't really know going in. You just find out, like, what do you got this week, and then you play with it. So, yeah, that pretty much keeps it as local as we can.
Mm-hmm. And the other ingredients, things like the buns, I think some come from...
Those come from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor.
Right.
Which I don't know how much you guys know about them.
Tell us about it. I mean,
it's a really cool company. Yeah, it's... You know, I personally don't even know the whole Zingerman's history, but my understanding is that over time, as the business grew from just a deli, and they had employees who started having ideas like, hey, we should start making our own bread and open a bakery, they would actually support their employees in those endeavors to let them grow and grow their own business at the mm-hmm. same time, which I thought was really, really cool. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, their baked goods are just awesome. Like, we tried a bunch of different things, and it's really hard to beat Zingerman's quality and consistency.
Do you see yourself fitting into the regional food scene in other ways? I mean, there are a lot of great restaurants in Detroit, in the Detroit area, mm-hmm. already open, more opening all the time, it seems like. How do you fit into that landscape more generally?
You know, even though we're only 10 years old, you almost feel like the old man. At this point, you know, there's definitely older restaurants in Detroit, but for various reasons, we drew a lot more attention than a lot of those places have when we mm-hmm. opened. And a lot of stuff happened after we did. Like, we really watched a boom of places opening around us. So I'm just proud to still be part of it. You know, I love watching the restaurant scene grow. I don't have that that mentality of, oh, shit, somebody's opening on our block, they're going to take our customers. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, you should be friendly and be part of a restaurant community. If they get used to coming in the city, you know, they're not going to come here every time. They should try other restaurants and then come back to Slow's too.
Do you have time to eat out at other places around?
Once in a while. You know, when I'm not here, I'm usually with my kids. I'm a single dad,
yeah.
So that takes a lot of time. But my kids do love going out to eat, especially for Asian food. So that's usually where we end up.
Do you ever have times when something you tried another restaurant influences what you find yourself doing in your kitchen here?
Yeah, I could say that. I mean, like the example with the pork belly, I ate it in Chicago, all of a sudden, like, bang, here it is. I took a trip out to Kansas City several years ago and spent about 10 days out there doing nothing but exploring and eating barbecue. And even though I don't think that I was influenced hugely by the food because I was already really accustomed to what I was going to go try there, what I came back with was different ideas on kitchen staffing because I was fortunate enough to meet a couple of people running those restaurants who let me look at how they were doing things. And that's what I came back with is like, shit, we need to hire some more cooks around here. Like so we're working a little too hard.
Density of workflow and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of those things. It's one of the reasons I like to go out to eat or to travel in general is to just keep fresh ideas coming into my head. You know, it's at no point am I going to be reinventing or inventing something new. It's all out there already. It's just, you just have to go see it and be reminded of it sometimes. But it's kind of funny when you come back and it's like, no, it wasn't about food this time. This is all about staffing and payroll. But at least I learned something.
Yeah. the block that we're on here does seem really interesting. It struck us as like almost like a mini Bushwick or something like this. There's like a great coffee shop down the street. I think there's a good like a sweet store or something like this.
Oh, the Sugar House. It's a classic cocktail bar.
Oh, is that
like a Prohibition style cocktail bar?
All right, so even more like a kind of Brooklyn-y feel. Is that new? That kind of feel of the restaurant scene, the business scene in Detroit?
I would say yes, it is. I mean, it used to be that like the restaurants in Detroit were really far away from one another. Like you go downtown and there wasn't a lot of opportunity to bar hop on foot. It's a really like take a cab or drive around city. And over time, we've really watched that change. Like all these abandoned buildings are getting taken over. They're getting cleaned up, beautifully renovated. And all of a sudden, we're getting whole strips of open businesses again and people who are actually bar hopping around and all that. It's pretty cool.
So that's new, but it also seems like there is an established barbecue tradition in Detroit itself, even as you're drawing on traditions from around the country.
Sure.
Were you conscious of or thinking about how barbecue is done here in Detroit as you were setting this place up?
Not really. I think maybe conscious of it in the respect that you don't want to do exactly what somebody else is doing.
Sure.
But no, we went at it completely from the mindset of this is what we like. You know, this tastes good to us. Like, we like how tender this is or how salty this is or whatever. It was really, it was a lot of just personal opinion and putting it out there and hoping that, like, what we liked, other people would like too.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, you know, one of the things I think always with barbecue is trying to find that balance between tradition and innovation. Is there much room for improvisation, for rethinking those traditions that you're citing or drawing on?
Yeah, I think so. You know, barbecue's been going on for a long time, and I wouldn't call it a rut, but you do have, like, those standards that depend on where you are in the country. You're looking at a couple different kinds of ribs, some brisket, some sausage, pork butts, and that's awesome. But, yeah, there is that point where as it grows into more into the entire country, instead of being such a Southern-based tradition, like you're going to see different mindsets of how to go about this thing. And like up here, like I do more outdoor barbecuing in the winter than I think I do in the summer.
Really?
I just like the snow, and I like being outside in the wintertime. And you can see how that can influence your food, not just with the flavors that you're trying to come up with something maybe a little more rich instead of, I don't know, whatever thing you're going for because of the weather, or you're smoking things twice as long because it's 20 degrees out, and so you get a different flavor based on that. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of room for innovation, but I don't think it's going to go too far off the rails, you know.
What are the actual tools of the trade that you use in the restaurant here? When I'm barbecuing at home, doing just like really basic indirect heat on a Weber kettlebell, but I assume you've got much more sophisticated
tools for barbecuing here, I would guess.
Yeah, well, we've got like two main machines here. One of them is Charlene.
They've got names?
Yeah, I named the smokers.
Nice.
Out of respect. So Charlene has been here since we opened. Like, the wall had to be torn down, bring the smoker in, and build the wall back up. So it was definitely committed to, like, you're not going anywhere. That one is it's a Southern Pride smoker. It's a pretty simple mechanism. A pilot light lights hickory wood, and the fire heats the smoker up in a rotisserie, and as the fire goes down, it'll hit it with a little more flame, get it going back up. Out on the patio, we have a Yoder smoker. Mm-hmm. It's a company out of Kansas, and it's a 3,000-pound monster. And that thing is...
What's it made of?
Steel. Yeah, it's a big steel beast. You can take a look at it when we're done here if you like. That one, though, is just a charcoal chimney. I get like an all-natural mesquite charcoal just to get the fire going. And after that, it's all just hickory and monitoring the air and the fire.
How do you know what types of wood to use? Is there a rationale of that?
Yeah, for sure. The standard for our regular menu here is hickory. It's plentiful, and it burns really well. When we first opened, we were using a lot of apple wood because we were getting a hold of it by the truckload really easily. Mm-hmm. But what that meant is we'd start smoking something at 10 at night, and I'd have to get up at 2 or 3 in the morning to come down here and load more wood into the smoker because it burns up really quickly. Yeah. We found with the hickory, it's got a longer burn time. I get more sleep. It works out a little bit better.
But do you still have to have people monitoring overnight, though?
Usually we have people here till at least like 2 in the morning. Mm-hmm. So we have them add some wood to the rotisserie smoker before they leave. And we're back here by like 8 in the morning. And by then the wood's burnt out, but it's absorbed all the smoke it's going to get anyway. When it comes to the big one outside, if I'm doing a whole hog in that means that, 12, 13 hours... I might leave to go let my dog out for a minute, but otherwise I'm, there keeping an eye on that fire.
Does it have a lock or anything on the outside? You never have to worry about anyone coming and peeking in there?
It's a lock, like in the sense that the General Lee on the Dukes of Hazzard's hood has a lock. It's just like that little clip that goes on it, which is actually in my key bowl at my house right now. So, yeah, I've caught people trying to peek in there before. It's made me think I should get an actual lock.
You're listening to Chef Mike Mativia. Next, he gives us an audio tour of Slo's Barbecue. That's coming up.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, this is interesting. When I was younger, so yeah. I get really obsessive about the music around here.
Huh. Is that something you think about creating the kind of tone or vibe of the restaurant in that way?
Yeah, well, you have to leave a lot of that to the actual staff itself, or they're the people out here working. Mm-hmm. But as one of the owners and somebody who lives a lot of their life here, you want to kind of have a vibe that goes with the food and the customers. Sometimes you just got to come out and look at the dining room and like, these are people, do they look happy? Are they nodding their heads? Do they look disinterested? And be like, I'm going to change the music and see if we can liven this room up.
Shake things up a bit.
Yeah. Or mellow it out. You never know. Fair. Like, these people are acting wild. I'm gonna put on some old jazz and calm them down.
Nice.
You wanna?
Yeah.
This is the entrance to the kitchen. We've got two different fryolators here that I'm surprised they're not bubbling right now. These two big fancy Rationale ovens that are an oven, a steamer, and a pain in the ass all combined into one.
Why pain in the ass?
They break a lot. Like, just little things like that. I don't know how many of these handles we've gone through. Mm. But yeah, it's one of... It's such a sensitive mechanism, and it does such amazing things that, I don't know, it's like driving a Cadillac. If something goes wrong, it's going to be obvious really fast.
Each of them has a bunch of racks. Do you use them for holding
food,
stuff
like this? Yeah, hold food, reheat items. We do a lot of cooking in there, steaming of things. It's pretty much a machine that can do anything. Like, if I were ever, like, a super rich guy, I just want one of those in my kitchen. And
I want one now, too.
I'd be good to go. I'm sure it wouldn't break enough, like it does here, if
probably not
it wasn't
much.
Being used 12 hours a day.
And then it looks like a big cast iron stove over here.
Yeah. This first station is the brisket station, where they keep extremely busy. Like, anybody who works this station, like, don't arm wrestle them. Like, they spend 8 hours
slicing.
cutting. Right. Yeah. Then down here is the center of the line where they do all the saute, the cutting of the ribs, and a few other things. And then down here is the pork station, which probably churns out, you know, a good percentage of the restaurant's food just because it's the pulled pork. And the amount of that stuff we go through, like, yeah, these guys stick busy. You're lucky to be here on a slow Monday morning where they're not running around.
Yeah. And then you got some salamanders, too. Is that what these are called?
Yeah. Those things, we use one of them to brown some enchiladas. Otherwise, they're almost constantly filled with macaroni and cheese.
Just browning the top of it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, on a day like today, it won't be so heavy, but, you know, get us on a weekend, we'll go through a few hundred of those.
And then the flat top, is that for crisping buns out?
Yeah, crisping the buns. We grill all the bread. That's something when I go out to eat myself, I don't know why I'm so judgmental about cold buns, but I really am. Like, yeah. Take a little effort and grill your bread, everybody.
Do you like butter it or anything beforehand?
Oh,
or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I am not going into it with, like, a calorie-saving mindset. I want it to be good.
It seems like that's important with barbecue, too, because you don't want it to soak through the bottom bun, especially with pulled pork.
Yeah, exactly.
You got a sauce.
You know, and it's just, it complements it. You know, a little bit of crispness on the bread. How could that possibly be bad?
Can't hurt.
Yeah.
Huge dishwashing station over here?
It is a big dishwashing station. During the day, we got Richard over here who can hold the tank together himself. But once nighttime hits, it usually takes two guys to do what he does himself.
Old industrial dishwasher for...
Yeah, it's a big conveyor belt. Before this thing, we had a machine, like a large version of what you'd have in your house, and we're still just cranking through. It was pretty miserable.
Yeah.
So
these things, I used to use these. They work pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, as we've grown over time, you got to kind of keep up with the technology and do your best to give the staff the best tools you can get your hands on.
Yeah. Is this your smoker over here?
This is Charlene. And
can you describe Charlene for us?
Well, today Charlene is a dirty girl. As you can see, we just pulled a bunch of pork out of there, so there's a lot of fat dripping. So she ends up getting cleaned every few days just to scrape out excess fat and stuff.
Off it. It looks like three racks in
there. Well, it's four different carousels that each hold three racks. There's only two in each right now. But, yeah, we keep the thing clean, but you don't want to go so ape on it that you're removing the seasoning. Mm. You got to kind of treat these smokers like you would a cast iron pan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that flavor is going to develop over the years in it, so you don't run it through a dishwasher.
Now, where does the smoking component go?
Back here.
It's got these two doors that swing open, but then there's a side door over.
Right back here is a firebox. And, you see a pilot light come out. You stack your wood in front of it. The pilot gets the wood going, and fire maintains the heat, and as the fire goes out, then the pilot clicks back on to keep your heat even.
So you mostly keep these doors closed, I assume, when you're cooking, but you can open that up occasionally and check the smoke levels?
Yeah, just to make sure that, you know, there's wood in there if you need to add any more. But yeah, this machine definitely spoils you because we have it down to such a formula.
Yeah.
Like going outside's different. Like if it's the wind moves from the east or something, it's like, oh, everything just changed. Mm. Where it is in here, it is not like that.
Yeah.
But if it was, I don't think we'd ever be able to keep up. And then over here is the pantry station, which they're making the salads on the menu, putting desserts out. Surprisingly, here at the barbecue restaurant, salads are not the hottest item. So
I can't imagine why.
Yeah, what's up with that? But anyway, the pantry guy, they do a lot of our prep too. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, for every salad he puts together, they probably just sold 20 pork sandwiches. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is kind of the salad prep area. And moving past there, you just come down to more prep area. And then our basement, where you got like a walk-in cooler down there, walk-in freezer, more prep tables.
Is that where most of the meat is kept?
Yep. Yeah, it's all kept down there. Our disorganized office. Yeah. Every couple weeks we arrange a cleaning and then clean half of it and then it's messed up again.
So you got some onions caramelizing here?
Yep, that's to make a smoked meatloaf. That's something I added to the menu a few months ago. It's like a little individual meatloaf glazed with poblano barbecue sauce.
It must be good because those smell incredible.
It's a good meatloaf. It's a lot different, I think, than what most people expect from a meatloaf. It's got a lot more barbecue flavor to it. It's got smoked Gouda in it, so it's really moist and kind of gooey.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can we see the outside?
Yeah. This is just the service drive where we've seen some pretty sweet accidents over the years. Seen a lot of cars get towed away. Then just the backs of all of our neighboring businesses. You got Sugar House here, Astro, O'Connor, the real estate office, LJ's.
And is this where you have the other smoker? Or is that?
No, that's out on our patio. We can go out there too. This is where the staff does their smoking.
Yeah.
I do my smoking on the patio.
Gotcha.
We're actually doing some construction on our patio right now to expand a little bit of our space, so it'll look a little disheveled out there. Even louder out here. This is our patio, and this is Jesco, one of the other smokers.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's a monster. You can fit about 170 pound pig inside of it.
Yeah, so does it opens over here?
Yep.
So you can face the patio while you're working out here on this?
So nice. These were moved so that, you know, usually with a whole hog, depending on its size, I'll either end up cutting it right in half and putting it on two racks, or if it's smaller, just splaying it out.
Is the top rack removable here?
Yeah, they're both removable. And then there's a big firebox down here.
So it's got four different thermometers on it. Is that so that you make sure you know what the heat is at different areas of it?
Yeah, it was a little challenge getting to know this thing when we first brought it here to learn how to regulate all the heat, but this thing's really well insulated. It's got a lot of controls for airflow. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've got it down to the point now I can get all four of them pretty much saying the same thing.
Nice.
And down here is just the firebox. Just nice water gathered on top of it.
A lot of rain this morning.
Yeah. So here's something else I'll be doing today, cleaning the smoker.
Uh-huh. And then when you're first getting a fire going in there, you do a chimney start or what?
Yeah, I do a chimney start with that natural mesquite charcoal, and once that gets going, it's just feeding logs into it. And
there's a top loading system here that we're looking at.
Yep. And then, oftentimes it's hickory just because we always have it around, but I also like getting a hold of other wood. Like, we got a stack of pecan wood back there right now I want to play with this week. Just different flavors that you can get out of it.
Get different, cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
You're listening to Mike Mativia. After this brief break, he talks about the logistics of running a barbecue restaurant and discusses some of the things that go hand in hand with smoked meats like sauces and, obviously, booze.
Can we talk a little about sauces?
Sure.
You have, I think, five different main sauces that you set out on the table.
Yep, and then just a rotating cast of, we call them seasonal sauces, but I don't really base it on what season it is. It's more, what am I trying to use up around here?
Sure.
You know, with all the beers we have on draft, you see a lot of beer-based barbecue sauces, local soda pop, stuff like that.
How do you develop a barbecue sauce? What's the process there?
It's a lot easier now than it was in the beginning. You know, when we first opened, I'd made barbecue sauce before, but not to the point where it is now, where I just, in the back of my mind, I can balance like the salt and the sweet and the spice and all that. In the early days, it was a lot of experimenting and a lot of sauce eating. Fortunately, most of the sauces that are on the table now, those recipes came together pretty quickly and easily. You know, it was just an idea we had, like, okay, let's do an apple barbecue, let's do a mustard-based one, and then we just started screwing around in the kitchen and see what we could come up with.
Do you have a favorite style of barbecue sauce?
I guess it would probably be the style they would call Kansas City-style barbecue sauce, the really traditional, like, sticky, sweet and tangy barbecue sauce.
Kind of like ketchup-based?
Yeah.
Or I mean, you probably use, like, tomato paste or something in it.
Yeah.
All right, fair.
It depends on the sauce. I mean, yeah. I enjoy, like, a fun out-there barbecue sauce, but I think I like making them more than I like eating them. I usually go back to the real basic stuff.
One of the things that really surprised me about this place, and again, not... I don't know why I should be surprised by this, but I was struck by it, was how... deep your booze list is. I mean, like, you've got a lot of really interesting and actually kind of weird beers and ciders on the menu, a lot of kind of funky sours and things like this. Is that your doing?
That's not my doing. I would put that beer list mostly on Tara Garrity. She's our general manager at this location. That woman's beer knowledge, it's almost annoying. It's just really impressive, but you start talking to her, and I've met other people like this too, Cicerones that I know and stuff. Like, you know when you're outmatched, like it's almost not worth having the conversation.
You just let them do their thing?
Yeah, you do your thing. Hopefully I pick up on something. But beyond her her knowledge, she's just got such great relationships with all the vendors. She's a really just sweet person, but she also... I guess has the restaurant's back. Like, you're not going to sell her something just because you think she should buy it. Like, she's got a lot of confidence in what goes into this bar. And she and I do talk a lot about the food and how that plays with the beer. So that's a lot of times when you see these really oddball beers here, if you were to grab Tara and ask her, what do you think of that? I almost guarantee she's going to name a food item in her description. Like, she specifically thought of, like, oh, this chicken sandwich would taste great with this beer. And all of a sudden it's here because it complements the restaurant on a whole.
Do you ever talk with her about those kind of issues when you're starting to develop a new dish? Or does that just come up
with
the fact?
Yeah. You know, she and I have been very close friends for years before this restaurant even opened. So it's fun working with her now and having such a good working relationship. We like to do events as much as we can here in the summer, be it beer pairing dinners or just fun patio parties. And that's when it comes to she and I having to talk a lot about just beers that she can get a hold of, what my mindset is going into the party itself. Like, what do I want to achieve with this? And then it's a lot of tasting. Like, there've been a lot of times where it's like, well, I had to go to work and they made me taste beer today. Where you will sit there for, it can be like an hour or two. With some beer rep, or, like, you know, you'll be lucky enough to meet a brewer that they brought over from Belgium just to explain his beer. Like, that's happened, and I was just amazed by it. Like, yeah, I'll sit here for an hour tasting Belgian beer with you. And then you just kind of write notes as I taste things. It's like, oh, man, this kind of reminds me of a pastrami. And then I just start writing that stuff down, and, you know, a few weeks later, you're probably going to end up seeing pastrami coming out of the kitchen and that beer coming out of the bar.
What's the most difficult element of running a business like this one for you?
I don't know. I try not to think about that part of it. It would probably be staffing. Just, you know, not just maintaining a staff, but making sure that the staff you have is fulfilled in their jobs and that they're happy to come here. I mean, there's no way you're going to come here 5 days a week smiling and, you know, thrilled. I'd think you're a psycho.
Yeah.
But in general, I want these people to be happy to be here. And that's, I don't know, that's on my mind a lot. Like, I'm pretty confident in the food and what I'm doing with that. But dealing with people from day to day and, you know, wanting to keep this respectful environment, that's a constant learning process. That's what really throws me for a loop around here.
For you, I mean, you are the boss, so it's got to be, you know, you're on a different level from your employees. How do you maintain open lines of communication? How do you ensure that they are able to come to you or make their feelings heard if something is off or... what have you?
I don't know. Probably effective use of profanity, you know. I came up as a cook, so I still act and talk like a cook. I'm not somebody who had it in their head, I'm going to go to culinary school and to be a chef. And then they went to school and within 2 years actually got that job. Mm-hmm. Like, I busted my ass to get where I am, like, working on the line. And I know what the line's like. You're a pirate back there. And you kind of act and talk like one. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm on the same level with those guys. I hope they recognize how honest I am with them about everything. And I seem to get that back for the most part. I hope.
So just maintaining yourself on the...
Yeah, just level. Trying to maintain that, like, I'm not bullshitting you so you don't have to treat me that way. Like, I'm honest with you. I'm forward with you. Be the same with me.
So how has this block changed since you first opened up here? What's it been like to witness those shifts?
It's got a lot more going on. I mean, when we first opened, there was LJ's down the street. They're still open. That was the bar that we would go to every day when we were done working here. And that was pretty much it. Music studio opened across the street about the time we opened. That's the building right there with the squirt sign hanging on it. So then it was just us, and then all of a sudden other things started to pop up. The burger place across the street, Sugar House, the great cocktail bar next door, Astro, the coffee shop, incredible pastries in there.
One of the best pour-overs I've ever had as well.
They're really incredible.
Just astonishing coffee.
Yeah, that's Di and Jess. Di used to work here. While he was building the coffee shop, he worked here as an expediter. Mm. So he'd work here all day, then he'd go next door and work on that. So it's just really cool to see somebody create these businesses from the ground up and just kind of watch the neighborhood flourish around them. Mm-hmm. It's been nice.
Do you feel that you're contributing to what's happening in Detroit, to the way that it's changing or growing?
I hope so. I really love a lot of the new restaurants that have opened over the past several years who are doing stuff wildly different than what we do here that I got a lot of respect for. I hope that what we still bring to the table is just reminding everybody that if you keep your product consistent and you keep your mindset consistent of wanting to be part of your community and give back to it, that you can have longevity. Mm. You know, because most restaurants don't last more than a year or two. And we're going on 11 years here. And, I hope that other restaurant folk see that. And then, you know, once they're a few years into their place, they realize, like, that's what I got to do. Stick to my guns, treat my staff right, make my food consistent, and I'll get that 10 years. And then maybe I'll get that 20 years, too.
There are a lot of persistent economic disparities in Detroit, a city that has some very wealthy people, mm-hmm. thanks to some of the businesses in the area. And a lot of poverty still. This is a place, a restaurant that's selling relatively high end goods.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel yourself fitting into the kind of economics of Detroit more generally?
Well, like you say, we are selling like a higher end item, but that's You really have to stick to your guns with that. There are people out there who want that food and are willing to pay for it. And if you were to compare our prices to really everyone around us, you'll see that there's not really any sort of disparity there. Mm-hmm. That we're pretty pretty middle of the road there. Yeah. And comparable. You know, I think one thing we've brought to the neighborhood is providing a lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. Even though and we do get a lot of neighborhood people who eat here, but you know, even more so, we get people from the neighborhood who work here. Mm-hmm. And that's been great, just to see people come in here, get jobs. They redistribute their money into other businesses that they go to. And we get a lot of customers from the burbs, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are coming down here for Tigers games. They're going to the theater. They're doing whatever it is that you do when you come down to the city. So, you know, our audience, you know, you're coming out of Oakland County. There's a lot of money in Oakland County. So you were seeing everybody in here. It could be like the neighborhood guy who maybe has enough money to go out once a month. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud that he picked this place, and I hope it was worth it to him. And then you get other people who they probably do this 3 times a day, every day, and don't even think about it. Like we've got the whole spectrum.
How do you think about pricing generally? Has that changed over the years, how much you're charging for stuff?
Yeah, well, it's had to change over the years because our prices change. Right. And there was definitely a spell there where our prices, especially for our meat, mm-hmm. just kept going up and up and up. Mm-hmm. And our prices never did. And so at a certain point, like, yeah, we have had to change the menu and play with the prices a little bit. But it was always in line with our own price changes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you basically set up a formula of this is what I need to make off this item because of this is what the lights cost and this is what it costs to pay the staff and this is what it needs to be profitable. And then once you come up with those numbers, the pricing gets a lot easier because you just put a recipe together and like, okay, reality dictates it, if it doesn't cost this, we close.
Was that kind of mathematical, profit-based thinking something that came naturally to you, or did you have to learn it over the years?
No, not really. You know, like I said, coming up in this, I cook and I eat, and a lot of these chef skills you pick up along the way. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that one did not come naturally to me. Like, I am not a math person by nature, but I've gotten pretty good at kitchen math.
How much of your day would you say you spend thinking about that kitchen math, about the bottom line?
Oh, too much of it. Like I'll think about that driving here. Like I have to remind myself to think about something else, you know, and then even that's probably work related. Yeah, it's too much of it.
For you as someone who presumably really loves the work, the art of barbecue, mm-hmm. is it ever a bummer that you have to focus on those material realities?
Yes, it is a bummer. There's really no other way to put it. You know, yeah. I have to spend a lot of time at the computer and, you know, I get it. I mean, there's no way around it in this day and age. Like everything from the way the schedule is written to the way the invoices are received, it obviously goes through computers. And so, yeah, there's a good chunk of the week spent at that computer in the basement office. And I would very much rather be outside at the smoker or even standing on the line making a burger. But I don't know. You make the best of it. I've gotten pretty fast at typing.
Well, what's the most rewarding part of the process of running this place?
Honestly, it might sound corny, but I think it's my kids' reaction to it. I mean, before my kids, I don't know what the most rewarding part was. I think I was too busy to think about it. I think it was the fact that I was taking care of myself and was helping to employ other people who were taking care of their own lives. At this point, though, it's that. It's the kids. Earlier in the year, my son had a project at school where they had to make a timeline of their life. And they had to come up with 5 of their most important life events. And for an 8-year-old, it's pretty, you know, you're curious, like, what happened in your life in these 8 years that are really going to stand out to you? And one of them was helping my dad smoke a pig at work because it made me feel important. And that really hit me, like, you know, because I didn't think that much of it. I've drug them down here a few times, like, hey, buddy, can you help me do this? And I'll show them how to clean the inside of the pig out and how to cut the thing up and all that. And I don't know. I had them out of here out of necessity, if nothing else. Like, I don't have anybody to watch the kids today. Like, come down here with me and we're going to cut a pig up really quick. And it really, yeah, the way it affected the kids, that it was such a huge deal to them. Like, I'm proud to be able to do that for them, you know?
That's awesome.
My daughter didn't have the same reaction.
I'm sure she likes the food, though.
She likes the food, the macaroni in particular. She's really a good. Very, very picky little eater. Whereas my son, like, he's like me. He's down for whatever. Like, what is it? I'll try it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
I really appreciate you coming to talk to me. It's been fun.
It's been fun for us, too, and we love your food.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Rogan. If you, like me, are a Game of Thrones fan, I want to give a huge shout out and recommendation this week to Slate's Game of Thrones TV Club podcast. Each week you can join the great June Thomas, Seth Stevenson, and Isaac Butler, three very smart, cool people, as they dissect every shocking power play for the Iron Throne and debate who will survive this relentless winter. You can listen now at slate.com/Game of Thrones. And if that's your thing, you can also on Mondays, or if you're up late, on Sunday nights, check out my weekly column, Worst Person in Westeros, where I try to suss out who sucks the worst on a show full of terrible people. They also talk about that on the Game of Thrones TV Club podcast. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about Working. Our email address is working@slate.com. You can listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Capper, and Mickey and I want to thank Evio Isaac for suggesting that we check out Slows. It was a great recommendation. And, you know, obviously thanks to you, the listener, for listening to this episode of Working. We'll have more for you next week.